Hi, this is Tony Tennille, and I'm getting ready to do my very first Skype interview with Bob Andelman.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. On today's show, I'll welcome a woman whose voice and pop songs have been a part of my life since the mid-1970s. The charming half of the Captain and Tennille, she has just published a revealing autobiography, Tony Tennille, a memoir. Stick around and prepare to hear a life story that is very, very different than what you may be expecting. Tony Tennille, a memoir, is an okay title for the Alabama native story, but once you read it to the end, you might agree with me that Tony Tennille, happy at last, is more fitting. I cannot deny that I had somewhat low expectations as I began reading the autobiography of the singer, who I always adored as a teen and held on to over the decades as a guilty pop pleasure. The glamour, the celebrity friends, parties, etc. Oh, ho-hums, we've certainly heard it all before, right? Trust me, you haven't heard this story. If, like me, you're old enough to remember the Captain and Tennille as a top-of-the-charts recording and touring sensation, you'll remember Tony Tennille's soaring vocals, her southern charm, and her big-as-all-outdoors smile. As a matter of fact, if you're watching this video and not just listening, you see it now.
Yeah.
As for the Captain, Daryl Dragon, the former keyboardist for the Beach Boys, well, what you recall of him was that he rarely spoke while glowering at his wife and pretty much everyone else most of the rest of the time. He always wore a hat, eventually hiding behind sunglasses, too. Now, I spent a lifetime thinking it was an act. Tony Tennille spent a lifetime wishing it was an act. Turns out, and this is where it gets a little rougher, the Captain was, in my opinion, and she never said this in the book, but my opinion, comes off as a miserable wretch of a human being, and one who spent decades treating his wife, pardon me, southern word, like crap.
Oh dear.
Reading Tony Tennille, a memoir, I thought, was a soul-crushing experience. Turning each page, you'll find yourself screaming, Tony, get away from that bastard. But as anyone who has suffered emotional abuse at the hands of a spouse knows, it's not always easy to make a clean break, or to make it work. Now, I'm glad that I read Tony Tennille, a memoir. I'm even happier to know that the subject of the book is finally free. And with that, Tony Tennille, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'm happy to be here.
You looked a little surprised by my reaction to the book. Did I offend you?
No, I'm not offended at all. I expect everybody that reads it is going to have their own opinions of what I should have done and what I didn't do and why didn't I do it sooner. And what I was hoping in the book was to explain why I did what I did. And then people can make their own decisions about what I should have done. But you really have to walk in somebody's shoes to understand what you really would have done in that situation.
Absolutely. And it can be difficult sometimes to read the book. It's one thing to read the book, but then to actually talk to the person who wrote the book. I like to think I'm fairly genteel and I'm not someone who invades someone else's privacy but once you write the book and you put it all out there, you have to ask, and this was quite the life story. How on earth did you ever sit down to put it all on paper?
Well, for many years, when you get to be as old as I am, I'm 75 now. So I've actually had a life. I've lived a pretty long life, and I hope I have more years to go. But people would say, well, Tony, my friends and fans, are you ever going to write your memoir? And I said, no. Mainly because at the time they were asking, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was living in Prescott, Arizona for 8 years, and I kept my head down the whole time, did no interviews, no national interviews. I just wanted to live a regular life and see what I was going to do about my situation with Daryl. Yes, I was unhappy, but so many things went through my mind. And I do want to say something about the thing you said about Daryl. I cannot blame him for the kind of man he is. And he was raised quite differently from the way I was. And he was raised in a family that was very, very dysfunctional. In my family's case, my dad was an alcoholic, a binge alcoholic, but there was no doubt that he adored me and my sisters, and that he loved my mom, and my mother loved us as well. We were raised with love, period. Daryl was raised with a family that had lots and lots of difficult issues going way back. And he had a father who was very famous. Carmen Dragon was an Academy Award-winning film scorer and symphony conductor. A little trivia for your watchers and listeners. Carmen wrote the score for the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But he was also a conductor, a symphony conductor. He conducted all over the world. He was the maestro. And I think my take on it, when I met him, he was handsome, charismatic man. But I think when Daryl and I started having some hits and Daryl's name, you know, the Captain and Tennille got out there, I think he might have been a little bit jealous of his own son, because he would often say to people, yeah, that's a Captain and Tennille. I'm the admiral, just to make sure that people knew that, you know, that he was bigger and better than Daryl was. So it's very hard to be raised that way. But of course, I looked at it as a challenge, because I always liked kind of nerds and geeks. Those were my favorite kind of guys. The creative ones, the mysterious ones, the deep ones. I was not much into jocks that my daddy always introduced me to, thinking I needed a really nice Auburn University basketball player or something. But those types of people who often are geniuses, many of them are, and maybe that has to do with their mental problems. You know, a lot of very, very famous and creative artists were had some emotional and mental problems. But here I am, Miss Southern. I know I can fix him. I can bring him into this light. I can show him what love is. And so I took it as a challenge. And I just knew I could do it. I couldn't.
Do you think that he realized, I'm assuming he's seen the book?
You know, he hasn't. And I said, I said, do you want me to send you one? You want to read it? And actually, the audio book is out now. Well, it will be out April 1st, simultaneously with the hardcover. I think he'd prefer to listen to it. I talk to him all the time. We talk at least once a week, maybe more often, because we still have a business together, our publishing company we still own together. And I just want to check on him and make sure that he's, you know, he's doing okay. He's a difficult man, and he's hard to understand. I still don't understand him after all those years that I was with him.
Well, I was thinking about what you said about his dad, and it reminded me of mm-hmm. what you wrote in the book, too, about his brothers, that when you met him, his brothers mm-hmm. had musical ambition, and that the three of them played together, but of course when he pulled away from them to be with you, that was the end of them. And I noticed there was really no mention of the brothers ever again in the book. Were they not part of your lives? Were they equally difficult?
That's about as far as I'm going to go. Yeah, there was a certain amount of jealousy involved in both those brothers. And so I just thought it best just to stay out of their way. And once Daryl decided that, you know, I was the one who could best express his talent as well as my own, rather than what he was doing with his brothers, then I think they were very unhappy about that. So I just stayed out of their way.
You get the sense that he would have been unhappy pretty much in any situation. I mean, you don't reference it really, but I'm going to guess that he probably was no happier playing with the Beach Boys than he was being on the Captain and Tennille variety show. I mean, it just...
In all the years I lived with him, I never saw him laugh out loud. I never saw him do a big belly laugh. I never saw him cry. I take that back. We were watching a production of Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, and there's a beautiful lullaby in there. When at night I go to sleep, 14 angels watch to keep, and I was sitting next to him watching the production. I thought I saw a tear, because it's very moving, but that's it, you know, that's it. He just couldn't for some reason. do it. He couldn't express any emotion or love. He just couldn't. And I was all about that. You know, that was me. Mm-hmm. But I was taking my leave from him. And I kept thinking through all this relationship. The one thing I did know that he I can't say loved about me because he didn't do that. He thought I was a great singer and a really fine songwriter. That I know. And that was a way I could win his approval by those things.
Well, I think history will show that he was right about that. I mean,
well, thank you.
So no involvement or support from his side of the family. There's really no reference to other than setting the table of who his dad was. And yeah. His dad, by the way, just to point out, his dad won the Academy Award for a movie with Rita Hayworth. Name of which escapes me at the moment, but.
Cover Girl.
That's it. I knew it was going to be something so obvious to me. Yes.
It was Cover Girl.
And so no involvement there. But the other thing that I thought was interesting is you were involved with your obviously you stayed close to your mother and your dad even when they were apart and your sisters are in and out of the story quite a bit because they sang with the band over the years. Before I ask you this question, I want to clarify for people who are kind of – we kind of jumped right into part of the core of the book. But this is not a story. There's no tales of physical abuse. There's no real direct emotional abuse. It's more neglect. It's more he went his way, you went your way, and you just happened to share a publishing company. You shared a business. You shared a house, but very little other than that.
Well, yeah, it's hard to explain. He just, like I said, he was not capable in all of the years that we were together. He never said, I love you, ever, to me. And so consequently, I didn't say it to him. He knew how I felt. I thought, I wrote all my songs for him. I wrote most of them, you know, The Way I Want to Touch You and Do That to Me One More Time. And some of the ones that we didn't release as singles that I think express what I was hoping for that never happened. But the funny thing was that years later, he told me or confessed to me, I don't even know what you call it, confessed that he never listened to the lyrics. I'm spending all this time, you know, carefully crafting my lyrics. And he didn't care about that. All he cared about was the music part. So,
well, that explains a lot. Do you think that when he listens to or reads the book, one or the other, maybe the first time he realizes how many lyrics were written for him, to him, to get his attention?
You know, like I say, we talk pretty often. And I'm getting little hints that he may be thinking back over the way he lived his life with me. And I'm thinking he may be having some understanding now. It's too bad it took what I had to do for him to understand it. But I think he's understanding. And I he's always said, I told him before I actually started writing the book with Caroline, my niece, by the way, Caroline Tennille St. Clair. I said, Daryl, I'm going to write a memoir. Caroline and I are going to write it together. And I'm going to talk about my whole life, not just with you, but my whole life. But when I talk about you, I'm going to talk about our relationship from my point of view. And he said to me, well, you've always been a straight shooter, so just go ahead and write what you have to. He knew that part about me was true. And so I know when he reads it, he will understand. He will, because there's nothing in there I said that didn't happen.
Right. Well, it's really interesting, because I think it's around page 46 where I read the book.
You did.
Where we meet Daryl for the first time, and up until that point, it's the story of this very Southern girl and her family. Who, you know, you went to Auburn for a couple years. The family had some financial hard times. Moved out to California, etc., etc. And then we meet Daryl, and at that point, I think, wow, this is going to be interesting because this is where, you know, I don't say that I come in, but I mean, as someone who was a fan of the Captain and Tennille in the 70s, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And then it goes completely in a different direction than I expect. I was telling my wife about it last night. She said, that's what she said. She said, really? I said, yeah, it's just, you know, it's just amazing. And what I was going to ask you before is, so we talked about Daryl's family was not really involved, or you're not going to
He had a youngest sister, Kathy, who absolutely worshipped Daryl, just worshipped him. It's kind of a father substitute, I guess. But and she was a fabulous flutist and a flute instructor. She had such a gift. But what she, I watched the two of them together whenever, you know, we were able. She would come and visit occasionally. She wanted the same thing from Daryl that I wanted, and she couldn't get it from him. And I could see it. And it was really kind of heartbreaking because she wanted the brotherly love that she needed from him, and she didn't get it. So,
well, what I'm wondering is, did your sisters, and you have three sisters, did your sisters and your mom, uh-huh. did uh-huh. they know what was going on with you all those years? Were they aware of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, we kept it from Mother pretty much most of the time. And she passed away in 93. She wasn't around Daryl very much because he was really difficult for Mother to relate to. But my sisters always knew. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were there. I mean, you know, Melissa and Louisa toured with us. Melissa quit before Louisa left. But they were there. They were in the recording sessions. They knew how he was, and they knew how difficult it was.
So you did have family that you were able to confide in who knew.
Oh yeah,
the struggles that you were dealing with. That was the only thing that I came away from the book wondering. I didn't feel they were in the picture, but I never got the sense that you ever confided in anyone. And I thought, did you carry this around by yourself for all these years?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't, because my three sisters knew, and I had certain treasured friends, close friends that I've made, and they're not a lot, because you have to, when you're a celebrity, famous person, you always have to make sure that why it is that people want to be your friend. Do you want to be my friend because I'm famous, or do you want to be my friend because you think I'm fun and we have fun with dogs together, and you're not overwhelmed by this fame thing? So I have certain people, and I do mention some of the names in the book of people who are special to me that I have discussed this with. And those people, my sisters, and a wonderful therapist in Prescott, Arizona, helped me finally make the decision I needed to make. Oh, I needed some people to, and I have a few of those women in Prescott that are very special that I used to call my Council of Wise Women. And I still do, who helped me discuss things. It's important to have friends who understand.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. All right, so I want to come back to the subject of the Captain and Tennille and good stuff. But I want to ask you about the writing of the book itself. I mean, was it hard to actually start? And then once you started, I'm guessing maybe it was impossible not to finish?
Oh, it would have been possible not to finish.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because it was a hard thing. You know, Caroline, bless her heart, she is a fine writer. And I, you know, the reason I asked her to write this with me, because I wouldn't have written it without her, is that she sent me some time back a couple of manuscripts she had written. One was for very young adults, I would say probably 10 to 14, around in there. And the second one she sent me just knocked me flat. I hated when it ended. I wanted to know what happened to all the characters. She created a world. I went, where did you find this? So I gave this novel that she sent me, the manuscript, to all my friends of different ages, and they all had the same reaction I did. And I said, okay, she's a fine writer. I can write with her. And the way we worked it out, we started 2 years ago, February. We were on a little family cruise, like a four-night cruise. And Caroline and Jane and I, my sister Jane and I, sat down during the daytime in the restaurants that were closed for the day and the bars while everybody else was doing what they do on cruises. And Caroline had her digital recorder, and we started talking. She basically interviewed us, and she has hours and hours of digital tapes that digitized interviews that she did, that she organized. And then I would write stories to her. She would say, tell me what happened, so-and-so. And I would tell her this happened. And then I could tell her, you know, what happened, but she could set it into a setting. She created the picture of what was going on. And also, which was interesting to me because I didn't think of it at the time, she threaded my life, my little one life, through what was going on historically in the country at the time. And I went, oh my gosh, this is really, really interesting as I was reading it. And then, of course, when I did the audiobook, that was interesting because I had to relive. I relived everything when I was reading it. So it was a very emotional time. Some of the book is funny. I don't want people to think that it's all just right. Because there's some funny things in there too. But you know, when you go over your life like that, it's very I don't know how to say. It's just it's hard, but it's good.
I was thinking of the word intense.
Intense. Thank you.
It is a bit intense at times, and that's why yeah, I say. People yeah. will be surprised if they expect it to be one thing. When they sit down and read yeah. it, they'll be, wow, okay. So yeah. I guess that's my way of recommending that you read the book. And actually, it's interesting you mentioned about reading it aloud. That really is – people don't understand. That is a completely different experience than writing the book, yes. especially when you have a co-author who's yes. doing the physical writing. You're telling your stories. They're writing it. But then mm-hmm. you have to read it aloud, word by word. Yeah. And suddenly it is your life all over again.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. When Caroline and I, you know, we had to work 2,500 miles apart for most of this until I finally moved here. She would fly out to Prescott a couple times. I would fly over here a couple times so we could work face to face. But mostly we were working, you know, emails, internet, that kind of thing. So what would happen is when I would, you know, if I would write something and send it to her, then she would Caroline it, which is what I called it. And she would send it back to me. And then I would read it out loud to myself to make sure that it was in my voice. And then I would make suggestions, you know, Caroline, I would say it this way, or I wouldn't do that, or I would do this. And that was how we got it to be actually in my own voice. So when the time came for me to read the audiobook, what we had created together was the way I would say it. So I was comfortable reading the book as it was written.
I tell you, you don't know this. I make my living co-authoring books, and I would say Caroline did a really good job of making the reader feel like you were telling the story.
She did.
Yeah,
she did. She's fabulous, and of course, my hope is after all this brouhaha is over and I go back to being, you know, under the radar, that Miss Caroline is going to get herself become a published author. The book that she gave me that knocked my socks off is called Rabbit in the Moon. And all I'm going to tell you is that we're all going to wear T-shirts and they're going to say, "Where in the moon is Tilly Truth?" And when you will understand.
All right.
Hey, okay.
You should have been wearing that T-shirt today.
I should have.
Start
we don't
pressing
have
it. Oh, okay.
We're going to.
All right. Well, so what was the – tell me some of the fun things to recall as you're working on the book. What, you know, what came back to you that maybe you hadn't thought about in a while that were fun, that were, you know, made you feel
well,
good?
You know, the whole business of muskrat love at the White House is you know, one of my favorite stories. And I've told it many times in concert. Whenever I perform Muskrat Love, I always told that story about Henry Kissinger. So – and you know, people that don't know me and don't know the song, and they either love it or loathe it, by the way, but people about the song. But they may wonder why Henry Kissinger is connected to the song Muskrat Love and why I dedicate it to him every time I perform it. And I don't even know if he knows how connected he is with Muskrat Love, but that's a very funny story. And that was when we performed at the White House in 1976.
That was for Gerald and Betty Ford, and the Queen was
yes.
there.
Yes. And, you know, the lovely thing was, you know, we had so much speakers and things, and we were in the East Room, which is a very small room, and it's really, you know, most suitable for acoustic performances, you know, like an opera singer with the pianist and that kind of thing. And you know, they during sound check, they kept telling us to turn it down until finally it was practically off. We were very nervous because we were afraid we were going to be too loud or we wouldn't be able to hear what we needed to hear. But when Mrs. Ford came in to say hi to us when we were doing our sound check, and I went over to chat with her. What a lovely lady. And she said, "Well, what are you going to perform?" And I said, "Well, we're thinking of this song and that song." And she said, "Well, you're going to do The Way I Want to Touch You, aren't you?" And I said, Well, I had nixed that out because I thought that would be, you know, inappropriate. And in the White House, and she said, oh, no, you have to do that song because Jerry and I love it. So I thought, okay, well, God, they're pretty hip around here at the White House. So
frisky.
I went back and talked to Daryl. I said, you know, let's do Muskrat Love. I mean, they loved it in the smokehouse where we used to work, and that's where we worked it up, the version of it. He said, let's do it at the White House. I mean, they probably like it, you know. So that's how all that happened.
And I love that you point out that Rolling Stone talked about how subversive you guys were for slipping these songs in at the White House.
Well, no, that was Julia Child.
Oh, Julia, was that it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Julia Child was in the Queen's party or entourage there, you know, listening to the concert. And she was very, very taken aback by the fact that we had done this song about two muskrats in love. And supposedly she was quoted in a newspaper article as saying that we had performed a song of sexual innuendo inappropriate for royalty. So, heck with her. She was a good cook, though. She had no sense of humor, yeah. And neither did Henry.
No, I like coming away from the book thinking that Betty and Jerry were still a little frisky at that point in their lives, and they had an appreciation for a song with a little, you know, something to it.
They did, and you know, I ran into them often. They used to come to the Palm Desert. I want to say concerts, but I would see them at benefits and things like that from time to time, and they were always just lovely people. And then as he got a little bit older, and we, you know, I would still see them often, he would say, oh yes, I remember when you did that song about the mice, and it was of course the muskrats,
right.
But you know, but I said, oh yes, Mr. President, yes, that was a wonderful time.
Well, so let's use that as an excuse to talk about a couple of the songs.
Okay.
We'd have to start with the one that, you know, made your careers, which was Love Will Keep Us Together. Mm-hmm. It was a Neil Sedaka song that I guess had only been released in the UK when you got
right.
it, right? So
yeah, Neil Sedaka wrote the music and Howie Greenfield wrote the lyrics, and Neil had released an album, I guess there were albums then or CDs, in the UK, and he called it Sedaka Is Back. And Kip Cohen, who was an A&R guy, a fabulous A&R guy at A&M Records, got a hold of that album, and he said, Tony and Daryl, come in, I want you to hear some of these songs, because I think you might find something that you'll really like. And we needed another up-tempo for our first album for A&M. So we went into Kip's office, and he played us several songs off the album. They were all very good. But the minute he played Love Will Keep Us Together, we just went, oh, that's it. There was no question. And so I think we went in the studio the next day and started working on it. So that's how that came about. And I'll tell you, that is Kip Cohen doing what A&R guys are supposed to do. He knew his artists. We weren't the only ones. You know, Karen and Richard Carpenter were there at the time. All kinds of wonderful artists were there. But he knew his artists. He knew their styles. And he knew how to find the songs that would work for them. He was great.
You had to be glad that you got to that song before Sonny and Cher did.
Yes. Did Sonny and Cher do
No, they, I don't think they were. No, I was just thinking that if the song was out there. And
I have. Well, I'm sure they would have done a really nice job of it in their own style.
One more highly eventually inappropriate song for them to perform together, I guess. I don't know.
I guess.
I mean, that's. How important was that song to your career as you look back, especially now as you look back? Obviously then, but...
Oh, well, my God. Every artist wants to hit like that with their first single out of the box because it was huge. It was huge. It was the song of the summer of 75. And, you know, when I would drive around... Excuse me, my eyes are weeping. I would drive around and hear, you know, the song coming out of car radios when I'd stop at a stoplight, or I'd see somebody singing along with it. Or once on a flight I was on, the flight attendant said, can you come back to the galley? We want to show you something. He went back to the galley, and they had worked up a routine to Love Will Keep Us Together, which was very cute, and they performed it for me. So you always want to hit like that. It was huge, and it was wonderful. And I have to say, in my opinion, Daryl did one of the most perfect productions of a pop song ever. He just had that gift for doing that kind of thing. Now, later on, as we went on and we had more tracks to work with, right. I used to call Daryl. I used to say, we need to call this Kitchen Sink Productions, because he'd put something on every single track and and double them up as that he could. But he always somehow, I finally understood what he was after when he finally would mix it down. But I go, oh, why are you doing that? Oh, my God. But then I would understand. But then the problem is, once you do that, and you have this fabulous hit, it's, oh my God, are we going to be able to follow it up with anything? You think, oh, are we going to be a one-hit wonder? Is that it? So it's a great thing, and it's a scary thing. We were just flat out lucky to be in the right place at the right time with the right music.
I think it helped too. I was just thinking about this and thinking back on the book. You were not 20 years old. You were early to mid-30s, I'm thinking, when the song broke.
When Lovell Keep Us Together started climbing the charts, I was 34.
Okay.
And when it hit number one, I had just turned 35.
So you had the benefit of having lived a little bit. Your head was not turned probably as easily as a 20-year-old, although there were incredible things happening. You got the TV show and the touring and everything. But I think it helped the song cross over to multiple audiences, because it was very poppy. I mean, it fit the kind of pop sound of the day. But it was something
had lots of hooks.
Exactly. Teens could like it, but also someone in their 30s, someone in their 50s. It worked for a wide variety of people. Whereas if you were 20, an older audience might not have taken to it quite the same way. Just, they're not going to be snapped.
That's interesting, and I kind of agree with that. I do. I think you're right about that. I think being more mature, being older, was a good thing for us. And also the fact that we spent a lot of time paying dues, working in clubs. I mean, we worked in some dumps, and we worked in some... but we learned every time we did a gig somewhere, we learned something about performing and how to do it, how to plan a set, how to program, a concert. All those kind of things were very important, and that was because of experience that we had gotten over the years.
Just like you learned to stay out of smoky halls. Right.
And my voice taught me that. I couldn't do it. My voice couldn't take it. I have allergies, and right now that's why my eye is weeping. It's because of the allergies. But I spent my whole career worrying about my voice, worrying, oh my God, am I going to be able to make it through this concert? And that wasn't just when I was doing Captain and Tennille. It was when I was doing the symphonies and the big bands all those years. Because those require really, that kind of singing requires your voice to be in really excellent shape, more than pop stuff. You can get away with stuff in pop stuff that you can't with the singing, singing the Great American Songbook.
Mm. All right, so let's come back to Muskrat again. This was kind of an accidental hit, right? I mean, it's that song that has endured. It was never intended to be a single, from what I understand. Tell folks where this song came from and what kind of its journey was.
Well, Daryl and I, when we were working in clubs, we were your top 40 group. And we would listen to the radio all the time, top 40 radio, to see if there's something we should be adding to our set. We did that. We did Billy Joel. We did Elton John. We did Carly Simon. We did Carole King, those kind of songs. And then I would throw in, occasionally one or two of my own, to throw it in there. So we were listening one day when we were driving to the smokehouse. Daryl was driving and I was listening. And I heard America's version of this song. It was written by a guy from Texas named Willis Allen Ramsey. And I think he called it Muskrat Candlelight when he wrote it. But I'm listening and I put my ear down close to the radio because I couldn't really understand the words, but I thought it said something about muskrats and something about in love. And I said, Daryl, tomorrow, got to go and find out what this song is all about because it might be something we can do in the club. So the next day I went to the sheet music store, and they still had them then, and they had it in stock. So I started reading the lyrics and I started laughing out loud. I thought, this is really funny. And I said to Daryl, let's work it up and see what happens if we play it in the club. So that's what we did. And oh my God, Daryl, and you know, Daryl did the little muskrat sounds that he made, the little solo thing that he did. And I sang it. And when I thought of the song, I thought of it as funny because I thought of these Disney-esque kind of characters. And of course, I didn't, being who I was, I didn't take it as far as maybe some other people might have thought those muskrats were doing. In fact, somebody put up a picture online of two muskrats doing the deed, real ones, which was not what I was thinking. You know, I was thinking Disney, but you know, it's a different time now, yeah, so I have to accept that as best I can. So we tried it out in the club, as I said, and people just flipped over it. And finally, you know, I had to just say, hey, we're going to do this twice a night, and that's it. And, you know, they would come up and offer us big tips. We never took tips anyway, but they would come up. Well, you'll play this. I'll give you $5 or whatever. And we wouldn't do it because I thought, you know, we don't want to run this in the ground. This is ridiculous. We know other songs as well. So that's how that happened. And then when we were doing our second album, we had already had two hits off that album, two top five, I think, gold records. And so A&M at that time thought, well, if you've got two off an album, that's it. We don't want to try to mine it for anything else. That was just their philosophy then. So they weren't going to release another single. But a DJ in Madison, Wisconsin, who played it on WISM in Madison, started getting all kinds of calls. What is that song? Who is that group? So he called A&M. He called the publicity people there and said, you are missing a bet if you don't release this as a single. And so they did. And I think it just surpassed way what they ever thought. And it ended up being our third biggest hit single.
That's good. It brings a smile to my face when I think
of course,
about
that, of course.
Silly song.
It's a silly
song, you know.
I know.
You got to have one of those in your catalog, right?
You do.
And then the other song I wanted to ask you about came after that, which was you wrote "Do That to Me One More Time." It sounds sort of like some people took Muskrat Love. You know, it's a very, you know, it has a nice sound to it. But then you think, sounds kind of sexy, doesn't it?
Say what you think, Bob. Say what you think. Don't be shy.
Oh God, no.
Yeah, I have to point out that it's "Do That to Me One More Time." It's not "Do It to Me One More Time."
Really? So you're
why lyrics are important.
You're clarifying
do
this
that
now.
Could be anything. And you notice as I recapitulate that idea throughout the lyrics, it's "kiss me," and then the other word is "say that to me again," instead of what other people may think. But they can think whatever they want. That's fine.
You're okay.
Do it that way.
Yeah. Were you surprised? Actually, you were probably extremely pleased that the song you wrote at that point in the yeah. Captain and Tennille's career took off the way it did.
Well, yes, because we had just signed with our new record label, and they wanted to hear what we had in mind for the song, I mean, for the album. And they came over to our house. We lived in Pacific Palisades at the time and played a couple of things. And, oh, that's fine. That sounds good. And then I had just written that song a couple of days ago. And it was, you know, I just thought this is a nice, simple, you know, little song. It's very simple. And I sat down and played it for them. And Bruce Bird, who was vice president of Casablanca, which was the record label that we signed with at the time, jumped up out of his chair and he said, that's a smash. And when I finished singing, and I went, really? I mean, I just thought it was this nice song, but he was right.
Oh yeah,
he was absolutely right. It was the second biggest hit single we ever had, and I wrote it. Yay.
Yeah, there you go. You know, hopefully continues to send royalties your way, I hope.
And it does. And it's very sexy done in Spanish as well.
Really?
So that out. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Spanish is the language of sensual love, I think. So
I'll try.
Okay.
was it "Love Will Keep Us Together" that you would do a verse of in Spanish as well?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, because A&M suggested that, you know, we had a lot of Spanish listeners, and they had a lot of Spanish people that listened to some of their other artists. So they suggested that we do it, the album, in Spanish. as well. And so basically what we did was use the same tracks. And I just sang it in Spanish. And then a lot of DJs had some fun by cutting between the Spanish and cutting and the English. And they all did it there. You know, one would do one verse in Spanish, one verse in English, and then they would reverse, or they'd do half the song in Spanish and half in English. And they had a lot of fun with that. And they could do it easily because the tracks were exactly the same.
It sounds, I don't know, I'm sure I'm way off here, but it reminds me of the B.J. Thomas song, Hooked on a Feeling, that at some point a DJ had recut it. To
really?
It became the Ooga Chukka song, you know, Ooga Chukka, Ooga, Ooga, Ooga. And then someone had that bizarre idea. I mean, it's different than what you're talking about, but nonetheless, you know.
Oh, yeah. Nonetheless, that is hysterical. Thank you for reminding about that. I forgot about that.
When DJs Ooga could still get away with stuff like that, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're having fun, and that's good.
Tell me about today. Do you still have the opportunity to be out singing?
I do. But I'm not.
Okay.
Not right now. What I would love to do, I mean, you know, I all the time that we were famous and we were out in front of the public all the time, that wasn't why I did it. That wasn't why I did that music with Daryl. It was because I loved making the music. The fame part happened because that's what happens. You know, it just sort of, you get on this kind of runaway train. And all of a sudden, there you are, and you're this famous person. And I was never really that comfortable with that. I'm a private person, as people who know me well will tell you. I love to talk to other people. I love to read, like on my Facebook page. I love to hear what people think. I love to see the videos they share with me, their ideas of this, that, and the other. That's fun. But as far as people that are close to me, it's my family. And then there's a very close inner circle of people that have earned my trust. I know I can count on them over the years. And so the fame part was hard. It was actually really, although I was wrestling with the Daryl thing when I was, you know, under the radar for the past 8 years in Arizona, it was relaxing because nobody cared about me as a famous person. They just, you know, hoped that my dog would, you know, get a cue when I ran her in agility, that kind of thing. It was that kind of a thing. And the people at the hospital, that was cute. When Smokey and I worked at the hospital as a therapy team, that was nice. When I first started working there, we had just moved to Prescott, and people didn't know I was in town. So when Smokey, my Australian Shepherd, and I would go into a hospital room to visit patients, they would see the dog. That's all they would see. They would not even see me. And then I would say 1 out of 8 people might look up and see my badge that said Tony Tennille and go, oh, are you? And then the local paper did a couple of stories about Smokey and me working at the hospital. And then it began to be, oh, you know, maybe 4 out of 8 that would recognize
me. Wait, you're going to tell me that you'd walk into a hospital anywhere in the country, forget about Prescott, but you would walk in a hospital, the hair, the big eyes, the big teeth, and people didn't know this was Tony Tennille? Come on, really?
No, I had my hair really short when I lived in Prescott because it was faster and easier and I didn't have to fool with it.
Okay.
If I was going to go to a dog show or if I was going to go practice agility or whatever I was going to do, I just wash it and let it dry by itself. So I didn't look like myself then. And they would recognize my voice. The voice pretty much always gave me away. But that was it. Some people recognized me through that. And plus, I was older than people remembered me. You know, they remembered me when I was young. So they didn't really recognize the older person. So.
Well, I got to say, when you came on the screen here to begin this interview, as soon as I saw you, because I wondered, I said, what is Tony going to look like? I mean, you know, she has that distinctive. We know who Tony from, you know, Captain Tennille.
Yeah.
And as soon as you came on screen, I went, yep, that's Tony Tennille. There's no, you know. No question about that, right?
Yeah, well, my hair is back long again, so, and I'm going to tell you, it's a lot of trouble. I kind of wish it was short still, but, you know, it's a good look for me.
It is. And before we kind of wrap up, I want to point out, in the story, where you really start to come alive is when the captain and Tennille stop touring and you have the opportunity to go out on your own. You do the national tour of Victor and Victoria. Julie Andrews had done it on Broadway. Mm-hmm. You eventually go out with the big bands and do the American Songbook. That had to be the point where you almost started kind of the second life. Right?
It is. And, you know, it's funny because one of the things you find out when you get older is that you understand why you did certain things that at the time you go, why did I do that? And I realized looking back that going out and doing Victor Victoria, for example, which took a year of my life, I was running away. I was escaping from Daryl for a while. And also when I would go out and do the symphonies and the big bands, which I loved, it was a relief because I didn't have to deal with, you know, the negativity that always surrounded him. It was like being free. So looking back, I can realize that was part of it too.
And have you had a good deli sandwich in the last 20 years? That's all I really care about.
There is a fabulous place here in Lake Mary called 2J's.
I knew you were going to say 2J's.
You ever been to 2J's?
Yes, of course.
They have this vegetarian sandwich that is like, it's got sauerkraut, it's got cheese, it's everything but the meat part in it. Mm-hmm. And I love it, and I crave it. I have to go there every now and then and get that. Yes, that's the best deli sandwich I've had in ages.
2J's is great. There's one in Tampa, by the way, in case you ever find yourself going west.
I didn't know it was a chain. I thought this was it, and I just love it.
I think they got about a half a dozen in Florida. So feel comfortable roaming about the state. You can find something good that's good. I'm glad to hear that. And people want to know why I would ask you about food. They'll just have to read the book.
They'll have to. The book.
Have you given any thought at this point? I mean, you've written the book now. You've told your story. Mm-hmm. Have you given any thought to what your musical legacy is or what you'd like it to be?
Well, you know, I kind of think it is already, you know, everybody who's ever had any big hits know how important the music is to the people who heard it and took it into their hearts, into their lives. And they can go back. I mean, it happens to me. I go back and hear a song that I heard when I was a kid when I was a teenager, and I go, oh my gosh, I remember that. So you are forever in people's lives with your music. And that is a really, really, it's a wonderful thing. And it's humbling. It's really humbling in a way.
That's very nice.
So I don't know what I hope it to be, but I hope they don't forget those songs.
They won't. Folks, listen, you can find Tony Tennille's autobiography, Tony Tennille, A Memoir, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it, or any of her albums, right now.
Caroline just handed me this. Can you see that?
Yep, absolutely.
There it is.
You can order the book or any of her albums right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you're watching this on MrMedia.com, you know you can see that below the video where we are, where Tony is, you'll see the cover of the book, you'll see a cover of an album or two, and you can click on that immediately and get it delivered to you in a day or two by Amazon. Tony, do you have a website? Has Caroline got you involved in social media? Can people find you?
Listen. Without Caroline and Michael, I don't know where I'd be. Yes, I've had a website for quite a while, TonyTennille.net. And that's two N's and two L's in Tennille. And then I have a Facebook page, which is my favorite, we had to call it The Real Tony Tennille because somebody else grabbed Tony Tennille and it's not me. So it's The Real Tony Tennille, and people can comment or, you know, message me on that, and I usually check it at least once a day, sometimes twice a day, and try to keep up with it. And then I'm on Twitter.
Really?
Tony Tennille, I think, is what I am on Twitter. So
nice.
I don't, you know, Twitter, I don't get that, but okay.
You do what you got to do. You got product.
You do what you got to do, right.
Well, Tony Tennille, absolutely a pleasure to meet you and to chat. Fascinating book. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you. And I hope to meet you and your parents someday when you come to visit in Stanford, which is not that far away.
idea to believe her. A bad idea to believe her. Turn up the stereo receiver. Turn up the stereo receiver.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of pop stars who won't believe that drug and alcohol abuse is not at the core of what went wrong with the captain and Tennille in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Hi. Nice to meet you. This is my very first Skype interview.
Oh, wow. I'm delighted to be first with you of anything.
I have never. I'll just be me, whatever.
That would be fine. That'd be great.